Well, welcome to Ask Your Herb Doctor. My name's Andrew Murray.
My name's Sarah Johannesson Murray.
We both trained in England and graduated there with a degree in herbal medicine, and clients consult with us regarding their health issues, and we recommend personalized advice in nutrition, supplements, herbs, diet, lifestyle. We can be reached toll-free at 1-888-WBM-HERB or on the web at www.westernbotanicalmedicine.com. So on tonight's show, we're very welcome again to have Dr. Raymond Peete joining us to give us the answers to his wisdom, explaining those things that perhaps not what we normally would hear in the mainstream, almost certainly not what we would hear in the mainstream, but nonetheless, very well researched, plenty of information there that people can also look at after the show, either by visiting Dr. Peete's website at www.raypeete.com. Plenty of articles fully referenced, and like I said, most of the subjects there will have advice and research that you probably would not have heard of elsewhere. So we're always very pleased to have Dr. Peete on the show. Thanks for your time, Dr. Peete.
Mm-hmm.
For people who perhaps have never heard you or listened to the show, would you give people your background, your academic and professional background, before we get into the subject?
After getting a master's degree in humanities at University of Oregon, I came back in 1968 to 72 for a biology PhD, concentrating on reproductive physiology. And hormones involved in reproduction are involved in everything relating to life and brain development was one of my second themes of research.
So brain development, aging, and the hormones involved in that gradual decline in good health. Okay, so just for people that are listening to the show, that we will be taking calls from 7:30 till the end of the show, either related or unrelated to this month's continuing topic of nitric oxide. I wanted to get a little bit into subject of iodine as an opener for the show, for people thinking about supplementing with iodine, and also open up a little bit about the Zika virus that's really catching media attention here. I know there's certain authoritative reasons for it, and there are other supposedly conspiracy theories. Yeah, we can call them conspiracies, but I think some of the merits of the conspiracies are worth picking up and exploring. Anyway, so if you live in live here in the area, the number is 1-800-KMUD-RAD or 923-3911. Again, that 800 number, we do get people from all over the states calling, so that 800 number, let me just spell that out for you. That's 1-800-568-3723. So, Dr. Peete, I was looking today, and I guess what's prompted it really is hearing the advice of people touting a product called nascent iodine. And I know that you've specialized in thyroid hormone, and that iodine is definitely a key component of thyroid hormone. And I think we've always been led to believe that there has been an adequate supply of iodine in the diet, and then they produce iodized salt back in the 50s or 60s, perhaps earlier or not, I'm not too sure. But iodized salt has been around, and seafood also contains a lot of iodine in its own right. So when I heard about this product called nascent iodine, they were saying that it was essentially not the stable, so stable ionic form, and was more available, was more readily taken up by the thyroid gland. And then I read some other articles about nascent iodine and how reactive it was. And I just wanted to feel you out, what you know about the thyroid's natural need for iodine, whether or not we are deficient, and whether or not we need supplementation, and if in fact this is something actually that may not be necessary.
In the 1980s, I was looking into the iodine nutrition question because I saw some women with breast disease who recovered quickly when they took supplements of kelp or thyroid hormone. And the safest thing, I think, is to correct the thyroid problem directly rather than counting on big doses of iodine, because the large doses over many years, for example, there are about 70 or more publications looking at iodine intake around the world over a period of decades, and they see that over half a milligram or even especially over 1 milligram of iodine per day over a population is closely connected with increased risk of thyroiditis and thyroid cancer.
Wow.
And so
it's aggravatory.
One of the theories of why that happens is that iodine spontaneously reacts, or in the presence of white blood cells, their enzymes can cause iodine to react with fatty acids that are unsaturated. And if you've heard about the iodine number to describe the degree of unsaturation of a fat, for example, the food oils that are highly unsaturated have a high iodine number. That means the number of molecules of iodine that will be spontaneously absorbed by a certain quantity of the oil, because the iodine attacks the double bonds in the fats, and where they lack hydrogen saturation, the iodine fills in as an analog to the saturated hydrogen content. So there is this tendency of unsaturated fats to react with iodine, and when that happens, the body can interpret that as a signal to the thyroid gland, possibly imitating the thyroid-stimulating hormone.
Really? Wow.
So it doesn't cause an increase of thyroid hormone?
It would block it, perhaps, or...
It can fill the site where thyroid-stimulating hormone should be acting, and it can interfere with that. So it probably can go either way, forcing too much activity or more likely blocking the effect of TSH. The polyunsaturated fats by themselves interfere with the enzyme which releases thyroid hormone from the gland. So too much of the unsaturated fats, with or without iodine, will have an anti-thyroid effect. But potentially, the iodine reaction could cause overstimulation by thyroid-stimulating hormone, or in its place could imitate the action.
But you mentioned the binding, the iodine binding to the double bonds producing this product, and in its own right, that could stimulate a inflammatory thyroiditis and or a cancer?
I think that's why the high iodine intake around the world statistically is associated with greater risk of thyroid cancer.
Yeah.
And if there really were a product that contained a more reactive form of iodine, that would just mean that it would attack more molecules. But I looked up the source of that product. One of the products started about 10 years ago. A man in Texas filed a patent that is just completely goofy.
Uh-huh.
If you look at the diagram,
okay,
it shows things that just can't happen.
Right.
And so it was filed 10 years ago, and I think it still hasn't been and probably never will be actually approved as a patent. So you can apply for a patent on any goofy idea and then publish the application and impress a lot of people.
But maybe not bring the product to the market. So
iodine supplementation is very risky, and basically you should get your trace minerals from seafood sources rather than from isolated iodine supplements, and especially not in combination with any kind of vegetable polyunsaturated oils?
Yeah, I think that's true.
So just to quickly wrap out this nascent iodine, I think the reason that it caught my attention was that the media spin on it was that because it didn't have and in chemistry, people hearing this will understand what I'm saying, but it's probably, I can go and elaborate it more simply perhaps, but it doesn't have a stable octet, so its outer electron shell isn't filled. And they were saying that because of this, it was much more suitable in some way to occupying these sites in the thyroid to produce thyroid hormone, but its very reactivity is counterproductive, because surely as soon as you, if you could keep it as unreactive as that in a bottle waiting to be ingested, wouldn't it surely react with one of the first things it came into contact with when you ingested it, just to fill its octet and become stable again?
The whole idea of a newly born renascent molecule. When I was in junior high and high school, the chemistry people talked about nascent oxygen, which for a few seconds after it's formed in a certain way is highly reactive. But that's because the electrons are simply in an excited state, like it had been sitting in the sunlight too long. That's an electronic excitation, which quickly passes as it gives off a little bit of energy. But in certain short-term situations of a few seconds, that kind of excited electron state can make a molecule useful for certain reactions.
Yeah.
But it isn't something you'd want to put in your body.
Yeah, there you go, right. Okay, so not for in vivo use, but maybe in vitro experimentations, it might have a some kind of a use.
So it's basically a more dangerous form of iodine that can cause a free radical reaction.
Yeah, that's what they're talking about, but I don't think it even exists in the product.
Got it. Okay, well, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM from 7:30 till the end of the show. Callers are invited to call in with any questions about this month's wide topic here of things like, obviously, thyroid hormone is going to interplay in a lot of it, but the nascent iodine that we've just brought up here, and then the inflammatory reactions that happen between estrogen and nitric oxide, and what we can do, what females as well as males can do to offset their burden. Number here, if you live in the area, is 923-3911. If you want an 800 number for toll-free for across the states here, it's 1-800-568-3723. That translates as 1-800-KMUD-RED. So, Dr. P, I was looking at some abstracts here that were going to form the show, and the first couple caught my attention just because they were based on isoflavones, and I know from our studying herbal medicine, soy and isoflavones were all the rage and were touted as being very health beneficial, reducing cholesterol and all this other ridiculously unscientific information that was purported. So from the basis of soy, they mentioned that there was an alcohol soluble fraction that had been shown essentially to basically cause female cancers, that these things were taken up by the thyroid, or they inhibited the uptake of iodide by the gland, and that this increased the estradiol in females, and that this was, I know that we've heard about soy, and now I know we're definitely aware of soy being very pro-carcinogenic because it's a estrogen mimic. But what do you think about this whole industry push that was producing, and probably still is producing, soy infant formula, which was one of the main foods that was generated from it?
I think it has seriously harmed lots of kids by partly the estrogenic effect. The oil itself has a pro-estrogen effect, anti-thyroid effect, apart from those little molecules, the isoflavones. The category of flavones or flavonoids, it's very similar to the isoflavones. The phenyl group or benzene group is just located slightly closer to the keto oxygen in the isoflavones, and that group seems to be the estrogenic group. The other orientation of the benzene group makes it more likely to be anti-estrogenic. And lots of fruits and vegetables contain the anti-estrogenic forms of those, but the estrogen industry as a background led to a lot of the sales talk about the effects of soy chemicals.
And of course, it's a hugely cultivated, GMO-cultivated product with patents owned for its propagation and its use. Again, no doubt another spawned product from big corporations who essentially want to own the product.
So, but don't all legumes have these a certain percentage of these isoflavones?
Yeah.
But just soy is particularly high?
No, I think the main problem with soy, besides it being basically inedible, I think the main problem is that it's almost all grown in the genetically modified form that takes large amounts of toxic pesticides.
Which are estrogenic too, right?
Yeah.
And again, just for the guys out there, I think it's very important to make you aware that, you know, guys have estrogen. It's not just a female-dominated situation. And soy consumption in males has also been positively associated with things like gynecomastia, which is another side effect, if you like, of estrogen activity within males. The very same thing, Dr. Pete, also, isn't it, with alcohol, drinking alcohol excessively can produce that symptom of male breast. So that's an estrogen-type reaction.
When I was a kid, just before the Second World War, we knew some of the very poor immigrants to California. And there was one couple in which the wife got a job, but the father could nurse the baby because his estrogen had become so high from malnutrition. And wow. At the end of the Second World War, when soldiers got out of the prison camps, lots of them had breasts from the effects of prolonged starvation.
But are we talking lactation too?
Well, in the case of this man in California, the wife said, pause milk ain't got much strength. But, they can lactate, especially if they have a baby nursing.
Wow. So there's there's enough positive feedback in the physiological mechanism there inherently to produce that, huh?
So I guess the high estrogen then raised their prolactin?
Yeah.
And then with the suckling, it produced milk.
Yeah.
That is just absolutely incredible.
Okay, so again, just for people that are listening, it just begs the question again, where things like soy and soy products, all we ever hear, we don't have a television really, or listen, we don't have a TV at all, but we don't listen to either broadcasts from mainstream media. But what I was going to say was most people have a TV or they're listening to a regular radio station getting the same spin put on things and the same sales pitch. And so I'm just find it hard to believe that for a long time the whole soy thing could exist and it could do what it did, when actually it's more like a waste product. People really shouldn't be eating soy because it's so dangerous in terms of its estrogenic effect on females and males, and those estrogenic effects are very pro-inflammatory. Dr. Pete, you've pointed out many occasions, and I'm currently on board with that same feeling, that the irritation and the inflammation that estrogen promotes is nothing but a dangerous process in the body.
And also, Dr. Pete, how would you compare estrogen levels with menopausal women and men?
With the aging, a man's estrogen pretty steadily increases. If he has a heart attack, it goes up sharply. Or if he has a traumatic injury, it goes up during the recovery time. Generally, there's a trend upward in men. And in women, when the ovaries stop cycling, they're up until about the age of 38 to 40, there is an actual steady increase in estrogen. And when the ovaries stop cycling, they stop suddenly producing progesterone, but they continue producing a considerable amount of estrogen until the body can adjust it downward. So there are a few years in the 40s or early 50s usually when estrogen is extremely excessive relative to the anti-estrogen effect of progesterone. But then again, after the ovaries have pretty much stopped functioning, the rest of the body, as the progesterone fails, all of the other tissues begin the same way it happens in men. All of a woman's tissues tend to start increasing their production of estrogen, so that after menopause, the fatter a woman is, the more estrogen she's producing, because the fat tissue is a good source of it. But any tissue after menopause, to the degree that it's stressed, will begin producing estrogen.
So is it about the same level between men and women? After the menopausal period?
I think that the women tend to be fatter in old age, and so they are more likely to have a higher level of estrogen. But just measuring the blood estrogen gives a misleading impression, because when progesterone is deficient, the estrogen receptor, as well as the aromatase enzyme that makes estrogen, the receptors bind it in cells, and there's no progesterone to destroy the estrogen receptor, so it just stays in the cell. And some of the enzymes that are no longer inactivated by progesterone, other enzymes capture circulating estrogen that should have been excreted, cause it to be deposited in cells. Still, other enzymes shift any estrogen away from the estrone form to the estriol form, which is the most active, intense estrogen. So everything that happens when progesterone is deficient tends to load up various cells all through the body with more and more estrogenic stimulation, even though it isn't being released to be measured in the blood.
Right. So the blood test could appear that it's fine, but if you have a large amount of fat cells that could be stored in that and other tissues. And what about weight loss for women who are in the menopause? If they lose that weight, do they then poison themselves with the estrogen as it comes out of the cells?
Just temporarily, but it's better to get rid of it than to have it local, because inside the cells it produces things such as breast cancer, lung cancer, uterine cancer, ovarian cancer, all of the tissues that no longer have enough progesterone are subject to cancerization.
So what about the women that continue to menstruate? Like I heard from this lady the other day that she had a friend who was 70 and was still menstruating.
I talked to a gynecologist who was giving his wife progesterone, and she was still menstruating at 60. And if you happen to have a very good system for producing progesterone, there's no reason why it should stop at 55.
There's no reason to stop at 55 then, right?
No.
I mean, basically, do you think it would be beneficial that women continue to menstruate until the day they die?
I think so.
The flamingos and the...
flamingos have no, have no life limitation according to ordinary mortality curves. they seem to only die by accident.
Oh, starvation, right?
Okay, well, you're listening to Ask Your Herb, Dr. KMUD Galveston, 91.1 FM, from 7:30 till the end of the show. Please call in with any questions you have, either related or unrelated to this month's subject. Number, if you're in the area, area code 707-923-3911, or for those folks in different states across the U.S., has an 800 number, which is 1-800-568-3723. Dr. Pete, I wanted to pick up on a point that you mentioned during your last discourse there, and I've not heard that before. Progesterone destroys the estrogen receptor. Does anything similarly happen with estrogen doing the same thing to progesterone receptors, or is it just that way around?
Well, estrogen activates its own receptor in most tissues.
Okay.
And it will activate inflammatory things which tend to turn off the progesterone receptor if you have an excess.
Okay.
So, generally, the normal function would be for progesterone to rise as soon as the estrogen has had its surge and then knock it out.
Got
so
it.
The estrogen is fine if it's active only for 12 to 24 hours every month.
Right, right.
It does its job and then it's finished.
But like you said, the tissues will carry on producing estrogen, especially in obese individuals and menopausal or even postmenopausal women.
Alexander Lipschutz showed that if you remove the ovaries and then implant just a tiny estrogen-releasing pellet, just a very small but continuous dose, it's very carcinogenic. But if you interrupt that or even a large dose with progesterone periodically, you don't get cancer.
Right.
And in his experiments, the estrogen uninterrupted was carcinogenic to uterus, breast, lungs, kidneys, brain, and intestine.
Yeah.
Basically everything.
Okay, so just another call for all the ladies out there. There really is nothing, I mean, I know it's a personal thing, but there's nothing wrong with continuing your menstrual cycle as long as you possibly can. Progesterone is your friend, estrogen is your enemy, and the only thing really that estrogen is any good for is the implantation. We have our first caller, so let's get this first caller on the air. Call away from?
I'm from Kansas City.
Did you say Kansas City?
Yeah, Kansas City.
Oh, hey, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Hi, Dr. Pete. What do you think is happening if someone experiences digestive cramps and bloating within 30 minutes when using vitamin E orally, and which still occurs even when switching to a few different products, as well as even when using several drops of Progest-D, which also contains vitamin E?
I think it's the viscous, oily quality that is irritating. Some people have that reaction, for example, if they try to use it in their armpit where the skin is very sensitive, the highly viscous oil can be very irritating. So I think it should be taken with food so that it doesn't hit any of the membranes in a concentrated form.
Do you think it's possible to develop a soy allergy somewhere along the way?
Many people do have soy allergies, but the oil doesn't contain any of the proteins that people are allergic to. I haven't heard of any documented allergy to oily soy products, such as soy oil.
Okay, do you think it's possible that for that person that something like 400 units, international units of the alpha tocopherol with 300 milligrams of gamma, delta, and beta tocopherol is excessive and possibly being excreted mostly in bile, which is alkaline, and possibly irritating to an already irritated intestine, which would maybe cause the cramps and bloating?
I doubt it. Because the effect of vitamin E on many gases is anti-inflammatory. For example, it inhibits prostaglandin formation. Similar to aspirin in its range of anti-inflammatory effects.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your call. We do have another call on the air, so let's take this next caller. Caller, where are you from?
Hi, I'm calling from Mexico.
Mexico, the first caller from Mexico. Well, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Thanks. Hi. If I understood correctly, earlier you were talking about how taking extra iodine can interact with PUFA to cause problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I know someone who took a few milligrams of extra iodine, and she went into some kind of thyroid, hyperthyroid-like crisis state where she couldn't tolerate any physical exertion. Her muscles were really weak and her pulse was very high. And years later, she still gets that reaction from thyroid. And I was wondering if that's related to iodine.
Back in the years when many people were in certain regions, for example, in southern Mexico, western China, and Ohio, eastern Europe, those areas were very deficient in iodine, and they would develop an enlargement of the thyroid gland. And then when they ate iodine, even a fairly normal amount, suddenly their gland would start forming thyroid hormone. And they, if the goiter was very big, they could have serious hyperthyroidism that could last for years. But if the gland was just slightly swollen, it would pass in about 2 months.
So that's a very real sequelae of using iodine in that particular individual, that they would have that increased thyroid production that would be resulting in what the caller just mentioned.
If they took their iodine in the form of thyroid hormone,
right,
they could normalize their body functions,
right,
and be replacing iodine,
yeah,
in a limited, graded fashion, so that they wouldn't go into those hyperthyroid states. And getting the required amount of hormone would cause their pituitary to settle down,
mm-hmm,
and let the gland gradually shrink.
Right.
Well, because that is treatment for goiter, is that you supplement with thyroid hormone.
Yes, to treat hyperthyroidism, the safest thing is to supplement usually with thyroid hormone.
So again, just to expand on the very first question to Dr. Pete about the nascent iodine, it's not a good idea. And also many other forms of iodine supplementation are not necessary. And if you need iodine and you have any kind of low thyroid, actually thyroid hormone is the best way to get bound iodine. Okay, did you have anything else you wanted to bring out, caller?
Well, thanks a lot. I was just wondering if it would be a good idea to do anything specific to try to rectify this problem, or if there's any tips on tolerating thyroid. Does avoiding iodine help in a situation like that?
The people who have trouble with the actual thyroid hormone, they can be either deficient in magnesium, because hypothyroidism makes all of your tissues fail to retain a normal amount of magnesium. And then when you supplement it, suddenly you experience an extreme magnesium deficiency in your heart, for example, and your brain. And so taking some magnesium at the same time as the thyroid will help those people. Others, if they're deficient in adrenal or ovarian or gonadal steroids, will suffer stress symptoms when they take thyroid. And so using a supplement such as pregnenolone will make them tolerate adapting to the thyroid more easily.
And what about, Dr. Pete, how some people, if they supplement with T4 thyroxin, they will have those symptoms, like our caller mentioned, where their muscles are weak and their heart's pounding, their pulse is high. And isn't that because if they're already low thyroid and they take the T4, then they're actually stimulating the adrenaline because they're not converting it?
When people have suffered for a long time with a low thyroid, they're likely to have extremely high adrenaline and cortisol levels, and that causes them to turn T4 into reverse T3, blocking the actual active T3 hormone. And then if they accumulate more and more T4, that will interfere competitively with the little bit of T3 that they do have, mm-hmm. so they can exaggerate the state of their hypothyroidism if they're in that really extreme stress state.
Because would you say that T4 perhaps is mainly only 10% as active as the active T3 hormone?
It really varies. In the 1940s, when they first synthesized it, they tested it on male medical students, and it was exactly as effective as Armour natural thyroid. But that's because young men, 20, 22 years old, have very good livers,
right,
that can perfectly convert it. But even at the same age, women are more likely to have problems with plain thyroxin.
But when they talk about T4 being weakly active, how do you interpret that, or how do you see T3 versus T4 in terms of orchestrating metabolic events?
The standard textbook idea is that T3 is four times more powerful than T4, but really, if your liver is good, you can get 100% of the benefit out of T4. And if you're a woman under stress with high estrogen, your liver isn't going to convert any of it to the right active hormone. And the more you take, I've known of one woman who was hospitalized, got more and more hypothyroid the higher they raised her thyroxin dose. And as soon as they gave her T3, she came right out of the myxedema coma. But I've seen people in less extreme states who got more and more depressed or psychotic or whatever when they increased their thyroxin dose.
Okay, I have one more question for the caller. Do you know if this lady you're speaking about was taking a T3, T4 combination supplement, or were they taking just T4 or just T3? Are you aware of that?
Well, yeah. Originally, she was taking an Armour supplement, and when she took the supplemental iodine, that caused the problem. And since then, she has tried different T4, T3 combo products, as well as a couple different pure T3 supplements. So I think it's something to do with this adrenaline or sensitivity to adrenaline that Dr. Pete was talking about, where, if I understand it correctly, the thyroid sensitizes the tissues to the already existing adrenaline.
But that should only last a couple of days, and then it should balance out.
Well, sometimes it lasts for a couple of weeks if you're really extreme, and you have to use little bits of supplements and be very careful about your intake of protein, sugar, calcium, everything that is counter to the stress.
So when you're in a situation like that, she was using very small specks of T3, you know, under 1 microgram sometimes. Is the thing to do to hold that very low dose for a couple weeks and then increase it in very, very small increments as the adrenaline hopefully comes down?
I've known people who, for a week or two, would stay with 1 microgram doses of T3. But you have to make sure your whole diet is very good. Having hormone tests and a vitamin D blood test is helpful because magnesium and calcium work together and vitamin D regulates them.
Yeah, and making sure that she's getting plenty of carbohydrates, like in the form of fruit juices, because that's, like Dr. Pete's saying, make sure nutritionally she's getting at least 75 grams of protein. I don't know the weight and the nutritional needs, but at least 150 grams or more of sugars and good fats.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right, thanks for your call. I think we have another caller there. So, yeah, okay, we have the next caller. Caller, where are you from?
Hi, I'm calling from New York.
Yeah, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hi, I have a question for Dr. Pete about Buteyko breathing and heart rate. Dr. Buteyko noted that as you progress with retaining more and more CO2 with the Buteyko breathing, then the heart rate will decrease. And I wondered what you thought about that. I've noticed that in my own practice that it does go down, but the temperature is still good. And I wondered if the metabolism is still good when that happens, or what you think about it.
Yeah, there have been experiments with animals increasing their CO2 and watching what happens to the heart and blood vessels. And CO2 relaxes the blood vessels, so it decreases peripheral resistance, and that makes the heart able to pump more blood more easily with less work. So it usually means a bigger stroke volume.
Okay.
So the decreased heart rate is a good thing.
Even though it's a lower heart rate, you think that that's you can still get the same benefits as you would if you weren't restricting your breathing. But I mean, I know you recommend a high heart rate typically for people that aren't practicing that kind of a breath control.
Yeah, but that's most people are running on adrenaline. I've known people who, one woman had 180 pulse steadily for years. Another person had been around 130 resting pulse for a long time. Both of these people, within 2 weeks, got down to a normal under 100 pulse rate when they supplemented thyroid. And one of the things the thyroid is doing is increasing your CO2, decreasing the lactic acid and the inflammation, so that your capillaries open up, you have less peripheral resistance, and so your heart doesn't have to work so frantically.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, caller. Okay, so for anybody else listening here, so it's always good to get people from all over the state. So we've had Mexico so far, we've had New York, Midwest. So let's keep it up. There's an 800 number here. It's 800-568-3723. We've got Dr. Ray Pete with us on the show, and he's sharing his wisdom. So I guess until the phones ring again for the next time, I wanted to ask you, we haven't actually got very far through all the questions I wanted to ask you at this point, which is good news because people have been calling, but may have to carry on this topic next month, perhaps, if you're available. I saw the article there, which again just highlights the estrogenic problem, that the benign and malignant thyroid nodules are far more common in females than males, and no doubt a consequence of estradiol. So given that the mainstream lie is that estrogen is good for you and healthy, and what can be done, you think, simply to offset the estrogen? I know we've mentioned progesterone, which is probably the first thing that springs into my mind, but in terms of reducing a female's estrogenic burden?
There were some studies of slices of thyroid gland in vitro, and they found that added estrogen caused the cells to keep synthesizing hormone and to keep growing, but to fail to secrete any of the hormone. When they added progesterone, it began secreting the hormone. And up until the last few decades, women, rather than just having nodules in their thyroid, they were the ones most susceptible to growing a very large goiter that sometimes was as big as a cantaloupe. Yeah. And the nodules are basically the same process of estrogen activating the cell division and synthesis of colloid, the material that the hormone later will be made from, and desensitizing the cells to the hormone secreting effect of thyroid stimulating hormone, and progesterone by antagonizing estrogen will reverse those processes. But when you get the cells multiplying and making the protein, you will get at least a nodule, maybe if it continues steadily, the whole gland will get bigger and bigger.
Okay, we do actually have another caller, so let's just hold that for right there and take this next caller. So, caller, you're on the air, and where are you from?
How you doing? I'm from right here in town.
Okay, your local caller, you're welcome. What's your question?
I was curious to know if this. I heard you talking about the vitamin D and the thyroid and the magnesium.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if that would have anything to do with what's called restless leg syndrome.
Yeah, Dr. Peter, that magnesium deficiency, or how would you explain restless leg syndrome?
There has been quite a lot of research. For example, they noticed that people taking SSRI antidepressants
mm-hmm.
Tended to have episodes of restless legs, and so they saw that nitric oxide and serotonin were involved in producing it, and those are produced largely from the intestine, the most intense problem of both serotonin and nitric oxide production is from an irritated intestine. And hypothyroid people overproduce both nitric oxide and serotonin, typically, and have sluggish digestive systems and often have a tendency to generalized inflammation. And the serotonin seems to be specifically what pushes those motor nerves that cause the leg jumpiness.
Does that help you out or explain things to you, caller?
Yeah, somewhat it does. It's not an adrenaline thing that makes the legs jump. It's the serotonin
mm-hmm.
having to do with what? Sorry.
All of the inflammatory stress things tend to go together.
So would you recommend, like, aspirin for restless leg syndrome?
Pregnenolone, aspirin, and avoiding irritating foods, especially legumes and raw green salads. Those are very irritating.
Those are things that increase the bowel production of serotonin.
Yeah.
Beans and raw vegetables.
That's interesting, because we had just switched to trying to eat better, and we had gone to eating a lot more of both of those.
Have you noticed your restless leg syndrome has decreased?
It's a female. It's my partner.
Okay.
And it's becoming very extreme, and that may very well be just from the diet, huh?
Yeah, if they...
She has a vitamin D deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
She's told to take vitamin D and magnesium.
Yeah. Do you know what her vitamin D level was and how much she's taking?
I don't know exactly in measurement, but it was very low.
Right. Well, the most drop forms of vitamin D now, they're 2,000 IU a drop, and if she has low vitamin D, it's probably below 20, maybe right around 20, which is very low. And they've raised the reference limit for vitamin D now up to about 45. So, you're supplementing with a 2,000 IU per day drop product, she should be really loading up with 6 to 8 drops a day for about 4 or 5 days, and then getting 4,000 to 6,000 IU, and then remeasuring her vitamin D
after about 2 months.
Yeah. Okay. So, like Dr. Pete said, bowel irritation, inflammation, will increase serotonin production, and that serotonin production with nitric oxide, which we're going to question for Dr. Pete about nitric oxide. Both those two compounds there can be predisposing someone to restless leg syndrome. Anyway, thanks for your call. So, Dr. P, I saw today, just in fact, I was thinking about it myself. Thought, how do you, I started looking at a couple of websites that do blood testing, etc., and I couldn't see any nitric oxide blood testing tests done. But I did see salivary tests for there were salivary nitrite strips to assess the potential nitric oxide production in the body. I know it will be formed from nitrite or nitrate. And this site actually was, this is the funny thing is this site was actually letting you know how you could increase your nitric oxide more. Now you'd be eating various foods, which I wanted to question you about also, because I know some of the greens here that were promoting the nitric oxide production were things that we actually are promoting as being beneficial. But there's obviously a reason for that. Now, so how do you feel about testing your salivary nitrate, nitrite level, and how predictive or preemptive that would be of nitric oxide production systemically?
A recent article just a couple of weeks ago came out suggesting measuring the nitric oxide or its products in the body as a way of diagnosing hypothyroidism because they're so closely connected. But I would guess that the urine might be better than the saliva, because for other hormone testing, for example, just thinking of food or being anxious or whatever can really change the composition of your saliva.
Right, okay. So you think that because that changes so quickly, then you're saying it's not probably more relative to test something that's there and it's stored and probably more representative of a couple of hours of physiology?
Yeah, I think that the urine will give you a good picture of your level of stress.
Okay, you wouldn't want to test it after eating spinach either with your saliva.
Well, here's the other thing. That was my other question. You see, now this website was touting nitric oxide as being beneficial, and actually spinach was a very good producer of nitrite, and how that was spinach would increase your nitric oxide, and they were touting that. And I know, and I just want to ask you, just to be realistic here and be real for folks, I know we mentioned greens, purporting greens and boiled greens and drinking the juice is very beneficial. And I know that you do say that kale can have a thyroid suppressive effect, so not to use much kale. But spinach, I think, has been one of those greens that has been portrayed as being relatively healthy. So what do you think about spinach?
If they're organically grown without intense nitrate fertilization,
okay,
and if it's well cooked, I think spinach is good food.
Okay. All right, we do have two more callers. I don't know if we're going to get them in. They just appeared on the dial. So let's take this next caller. Caller, where are you from?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air. Where are you from?
Hi, yeah, I'm from Shelter Cove.
Shelter Cove. Hi, what's your question?
My question is it's for my daughter, actually. She wants to take testosterone.
Okay.
And I'm wondering what his take on it is, if he has any experience with that, how she can keep herself healthy.
How old is she, and what's the indication for taking the testosterone?
Well, she's a transgender. She wants to be more male, and she is 16.
16. Okay. And did you catch what the symptom was?
Oh, she's transgender.
Oh, okay, transgender. I didn't really hear that properly. Dr. Pete?
Wanting to masculinize?
Yes.
I think that's safe, but it should be backed up with pregnenolone and some progesterone to keep things in balance, because the tendency is, if you're under stress of any sort, for the testosterone to turn to estrogen, and the pregnenolone and progesterone will limit that conversion.
Okay.
Did if you have access to either of those, both of those can be obtained. So
okay.
Progesterone and pregnenolone, typically for a female anyway, they would normally be producing them, and I don't know exactly the details of the case and how the transgender nature of this subject is either affected adversely or positively. So in terms of their exposure to their own natural progesterone being female and or supplementing with pregnenolone, then that will offset the potentially negative effects that may occur with using testosterone in a female.
Because it could convert to estrogen and then become dangerously out of balance.
And watching thyroid function.
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for your call. We better take this next question.
Thank you for your help.
You're welcome. Okay. So, caller, we've got about 3 minutes. If you can get your question out to the doctor here and do it in 3 minutes and get a response, we'll wrap the show up. Where are you from? Are they there? Hey, caller, are you on the air? All right. We had the second caller, Dr. Pete, but never mind, because we've only got 5 minutes left. So, okay. All right. I don't even know if we've got time to perhaps ask another question without running out of time, but I'll try here. And I think we'll definitely open this up against next month if you are available, because we've hardly got any questions asked here because we've had so many callers, and that's a good thing. I wanted to ask you again, and with, I guess again, the female issue in estrogen and inflammation and cancers, et cetera, are pretty obvious as definite realities here. In terms of the effect of iodide uptake by thyroid cells, the inhibitory effects that estrogen has on that, in a female, again, would you be typically just wanting to lower estrogenic burden by offsetting that with progesterone and pregnenolone and or thyroid?
Thyroid and good, adequate nutrition, all the vitamins and minerals are involved in controlling, keeping estrogen under the safe limit. And when you inhibit the formation of thyroid hormone, either with an iodine deficiency or an estrogen excess, the thyroid-stimulating hormone fails to make the thyroxine and T3, and so it keeps stimulating not only the thyroid gland, making it grow and get bigger or nodules to form, but it has a related effect on every tissue to some extent, especially the ovaries. Polycystic ovarian syndrome is associated with low thyroid and especially high TSH.
Right.
TSH drives inflammation so that the so-called autoimmune conditions associated with high estrogen, women are far more susceptible to all types of autoimmune diseases than males. And that's largely because of the high TSH exposure driving things like tumor necrosis factor and the various cytokines and interleukins and prostaglandins that are activated.
Excellent. I don't want to cut you short, Dr. Pete, and I really appreciate your knowledge, as do I know all the people that have tuned in and taken the time to listen and call from all over. So a really good show from all over the country. I appreciate people calling. Dr. Pete's website, let me just sign off giving out your information, Dr. Pete, so people can find out more.
Unless there was any last words you wanted to say, Dr. Pete.
Nope.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay,
so Dr. Pete has a pretty extensive referenced library in some ways of symptoms and diseases, and the mainstream science is argued against with real science. So the objective science of non-profiteering organizations is brought out. So much of the details that you'll find there and listed in the fully referenced sections that come with each article on thyroid hormone, saturated fats, regular hormones, pregnenolone, estradiol, whether it's salt or sugar or cholesterol, any of the other articles that he's done, there's a whole range of them fully referenced. His website, www.raypeat.com. It's 1 minute to the hour. My name's Andrew.
My name's Sarah Johannesson Murray.
And we can be reached at westernbotanicalmedicine.com, or you can call an 800 number, 1-888-WBM-HERB, 9 to 5. Thanks for your time. And again, next month we'll bring out more questions for the doctor, and there'll be, contrary to public and regular opinion, which is always a good thing to give you the alternative, then you can make your mind up. The facts are out there if you want to look for them. Okay, good night.
Thank you for listening.